Hey there, before we get started today, I just wanted to say a big thanks to Vitally and ChargeB for sponsoring this episode, which allows me to continue producing Churn FM as an independent creator. Vitally came in at a vital time for me, and perhaps they can for you too. If you're looking to maximize the productivity, visibility, and collaboration of your CS team while increasing NRR and streamlining operations, Vitally is the all-in-one customer success platform to help you do just that. They're also currently giving away a free pair of AirPods to all Churn FM listeners when you take a qualified demo with them. So if you're in the market for a CS platform, visit vitally.io/churnfm today to schedule your demo and get your AirPods. That's vitally.io/churnfm. And in other news, ChargeB just launched their much-awaited 2024 State of the Subscriptions and Revenue Growth Report. With an exclusive focus on retention strategies, pricing trends, and churn rate projections based on a survey of over 300 subscription businesses. I personally got an early sneak peek, and you don't want to miss this one. To grab a copy, you can visit chargebee.com/churnfm. That's chargebee.com/churnfm. With that being said, let's jump to today's episode.
It's very unstructured, and many times difficult to implement. So it's not even that it's high volume, low volume. It's high volume, good data, low volume, and even the low volume is poor data. Or very emotional commentary from the individuals, kind of actors, your SDRs and AEs and CS kind of personnel for where you kind of have to decipher it and apply some sort of value to it.
You don't just gun for revenue in the door.
This is Churn.fm, the podcast for subscription economy pros. Each week, we hear how the world's fastest growing companies are tackling churn and using retention to fuel their growth.
How do you build a habit-forming product?
We crossed over that magic threshold to negative churn.
You need to invest in customer success. It always comes down to retention and engagement.
Completely bootstrapped, profitable, and growing.
Strategies, tactics, and ideas brought together to help your business thrive in the subscription economy. I'm your host, Andrew Michael, and here's today's episode.
Hey, Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thanks much for having me.
It's great to have you. For the listeners, Dennis is the CEO and founder of Launch Brightly, enabling customer support teams to remove the unnecessary burden of manually updating product imagery in your help center. Prior to Launch Brightly, Dennis was the CEO and co-founder of X.ai, which was acquired by Bezobo in 2021. So my first question for you today, Dennis, is what motivated you to get started again with Launch Brightly after spending over 8 years building X.ai?
It's a good question. And if I'm brutally honest, I did sell my wife on the idea that X.ai would be the last venture and saying, I haven't done anything but startups since we got together 26, 7 years ago. So doing that for a quarter of a century, make a few monies along the way, seemed good, fair, honest, call it the day, hang up my spurs or whatever you would say. It's just difficult to get to the end of something which you really enjoy to just say, well, I guess that's that. As in, what is it that I'm supposed to do then? As in, it can't be nothing. It must be something. And there's this, I'm going to not go on a rant here, but there's this idea from some entrepreneurs, or probably most people outside of the kind of sphere that you and me kind of live in, that suggest once you reach an exit or two, or made a few monies, had a little bit of success, whatever the definition, you're supposed to go to the other side of the table, become some angel investor or be partner at some VC firm, which is just confusing to me because they're two very different jobs. They might exist in the same universe, but they're two different jobs and there's no relationship. So I never had that lust or idea. If anything, I tried to kind of shy away from it. To come back and then answer your question, I do think entrepreneurship should be a lifelong career, not a single item on a bucket list for where I would like to try it for 2 or 3 years. The most likely outcome is that you die, the default setting for any startup, and then I can cross it off. I just like that whole idea of doing startups. So I somehow sold my wife, family, surroundings on doing yet another venture. And I'm probably just going to continue to the very end. And one day at the office, I'll just keel over and that would have been a good life.
Yeah. When you say you sold your wife and your kids, like in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, you've like got a pretty penny for them now and you can just focus on the business. But what you're saying is you sold them on the idea of starting a new business. Yeah. I feel personally that to some degree, entrepreneurs are addicts. And I'm also interested in maybe starting a show on this very topic. And in some ways, like our addiction manifests itself in positive ways. And in other times, it can manifest itself in really negative ways that can impact us and others around us. So, but yeah, how do you see it?
I think if you love and really take joy in the journey, and I fully kind of appreciate the idea of this type of human beings being addicts, it's a little dramatic. But I see where you're coming from. Perhaps just an excitement to go do something new or crash something out of nothing into something. And that excitement, sure, might just rhyme with what other people are getting sucked into and can't escape. And I find the journey super romantic. Many people hate the whole 0-1, as in, no money, no customers, no product, no prospects, no hope. We're going to die very soon. And that part, I just really liked. I said, it's just me and a Diet Coke and a laptop. And tomorrow, perhaps a few hundred lines of code. And the day after, perhaps a co-founder. And the day after, perhaps a couple of employees. And in a few months, perhaps something that resembles a beta customer. And perhaps in a few months after that, something that could resemble a mini kind of contract and a few monies coming in. But I really just personally enjoy the journey. As in, it's not a penalty or some a bucket of pain which I need to swallow so I can get to what I really like. That could be some sort of outcome or buy what I think I need. No, I just like playing it for the love of the sport. And then, sure, if you love the sport, sometimes you get a trophy.
Yeah. No, for sure. That resonates completely with me as well. I think it's that 0-1 phase, like taking a problem and being able to come and meet it with a good solution in the market and figuring that out, because it's not very easy. Like you said, like 9 out of 10 startups die, and it's that challenge just to get it to that end post and being able to see like success at the end of the day. But it's that figuring it out. It's like going from nothing, like you say, like in seeing things manifest from your mind onto a screen or onto a physical product.
It's awesome, right? And the funny thing here is, if you think about it, take any investor, doesn't matter the size of the fund, we'll just kind of make it up. They have $100 million. They need to invest that over 4 years. They are at a certain stage, might invest in some 20 odd companies a year. Their funnel will look like 1,000 at the top, a lot of flim-flam. Shouldn't even be at the top. It'll disappear. And all the way down the funnel, to some point, 20 get a check. Out of those 20, doesn't matter what the real distribution is. Let's say 16 go tits up, 2 or 3 go sideways, 1 or 2 might pay for the fund in total. And that's it. If that's the funnel, and you and me go out with the belief that we can do one startup, that is kind of suggesting that I'm some sort of savant that can just jump into the end, suggesting that whatever they pick, and they're trying to pick the best of the best. Like, they're not giving idiots checks. They're trying to give it to people who look somewhat plausible and being able to kind of make some form of return. So you might almost never able to do things in parallel. So you have to do them in serial. So you and me are not running the 4-year fund. You and me as entrepreneurs are running the 50-year fund. So we can't really do what 20, we can pass to 8-10 ventures over 50 years. I'm on number 6. And really, you should just assume most of them wouldn't work. If some of them do, great. You should kind of pay for the rest. And that's still a lifelong setting where you bathe in entrepreneurship. And hopefully, you get a little bit better from one startup to the next. But it's the 50-year fund.
Yeah, I like the way of looking at it like that. And I hope your wife knows that you're in for another 4 after this.
You sell them one at a time.
One at a time. Nice. So today we chatted a little bit before the show. We thought it would be interesting to talk about. I think you have a very unique perspective coming at from two different business models, if we have it as that, or different types of clients. So you've worked in a business like X.ai, where it's really a very bottoms up, low average selling price for the product. You onboard one or two users, slowly but surely more of those users onboard in an account, and eventually maybe someone from procurement comes and says, "Hey, Dennis, let's bring this all together. Let's get a contract going." And you've worked in the other end of the scale where you're selling software, large prices, high ASP, contracts in place from day one, really working with the customer success organization and trying to deliver value there through various initiatives. So I'm keen to talk about the differences today that you've seen in these two different paths and perhaps some of the similarities that we see. So for businesses that are thinking, okay, who they're serving, if they're serving a low ASP, these are some of the things that you've seen to be effective versus a high ASP, and trying to understand clearly what the difference should be and why they shouldn't adopt one approach if they have one or the other.
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's obviously a potent map for where we can't explore all of the items on that map. We can pick out a few, and we shouldn't suggest that it's exhaustive, as in that is the defining difference between the two particular kind of avenues which you can take. And by the way, many times it is really a choice and not the particular product that dictates whether you go bottoms up or top down. As in, Zoom picked, probably still to a large degree, a bottoms up, even though their average contract value now is much, much higher than when they started. So they figured out how they can turn these into real enterprise contracts. But it's really how you imagine you can best capture your market. And sometimes there's just not really a single player mode, or a idea of a free edition. Could be that onboarding is extremely kind of complex and Andrew can't just sign up on Thursday night and kind of get started on his own. The whole thing is really an organizational change over many, many months. And for that, we can only do top down. Many times it's not really the product. Now, I'll pick a few here. One thing that I certainly noticed, disclaimer, anybody taking notes here, anything which I say, it's just opinion. Things I believe doesn't make them true, but things I really believe. So you can take it for what it is. But one thing I certainly noticed was that when we did bottoms up, so I'd done 5 ventures prior to launch Brightly. 3 of them were straight top down. Wine and dine, the whole thing, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 month sales cycles from initial kind of high and low to pen on paper. And I've done one true kind of bottoms up and one in the kind of in the middle. We can talk about that as well. That was the one venture that didn't work out. Perhaps we shouldn't have done the middle. But the one thing I certainly noticed was that there is a ton of real experimentation going on when you're doing bottoms up, simply because you have high volume. So the A/B or multivariate types of tests that you can run on your funnel, which is having high velocity, just allows you to do things that you can't really do. If I look at our venture before X.AI, when we got acquired, we had 130 contracts, all in all. Very proud, like very successful. It was all good, but 130. Well, that was a morning at X.AI, right? I said, let's just roll through the system kind of all the time. So we couldn't really do the same type of experimentation. That is super interesting. So if you're doing bottoms up, you certainly need to build some part of your organization that are tuned to the idea that every week, if you're not running half a dozen some experiments, you're probably not doing it right. Or certainly robbing yourself from an opportunity to highly optimize churn, retention, anything else which you really, really care about. That is very visible. And perhaps obvious. I think what happens is that people know it, but even though they know it, they actually don't build the team to take advantage of it. As in, if you don't have the right software in place to run these experiments, or have the right kind of data infrastructure put in place to run these experiments, or have the right analyst put in place to try to kind of extract insight from these, or have the right organizational willingness to change things and change the offer, which can look a little chaotic, and many people end up just really disliking it. As in, they're just not a good fit. Not really anything to say about their skill set. They like the idea of cementing things and putting one brick in place at a time and keeping it for the long period of time, where you should be able and willing to put in place 19 bricks over the next 2 or 3 weeks RibOps 17, like code pushed to production that we're now revoking and saying those experiments didn't yield the results we had hoped for. Perhaps some of them were kind of negative. That's one. We could drill in on that one because I find it very kind of interesting and how you build those particular teams to run these. On the other end, you do optimization in different places. The way we certainly did it was that we became very good at describing each of the steps in our sales funnel and forever trying to figure out whether we had the right number of steps in our funnel. And you'll have somewhere between half a dozen to short of a full dozen number of steps in your sales funnel. And you'll have a sales cycle anywhere between, if it's kind of four figures, 2 or 3 months sales cycle, six figures, perhaps it's more like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 months, depending on the type of kind of vertical you're selling into. And by being really good at each of the steps as an understanding, I'm trying to sell you a 140K contract, Andrew, and we've had some conversation. I need to know exactly where you're at in my funnel so I can optimize on activities that bring people from one step to the next. And I wouldn't call it experiments. I would probably more call it optimization, because there's simply not, again, as I said before, room to run experiments. I couldn't do 7 different experiments on 11 leads. But what I could do is say, hey, tomorrow from this initial step to the next, say I have some step for where we have a trial period where you're beta testing some particular features that we believe are strong indicators or increase the probability of moving to the next step again. Well, to do that, I have 2 or 3 kind of things I do. I might be able to optimize. I might have a wild idea of trying to do something new. If you do something new, we used to do interviewing to figure out whether the new idea was even worth pursuing, simply because we didn't have that many we could try it on. So we did a lot of interviewing, trying to figure out, if I do this set of activities, is that something which I might want to be willing to shift to and start this kind of optimization valve where you tune it ever so slightly, like, okay, I tuned it. It was just a different way I did my script at this step, or I moved kind of the SDR a little bit further up. I moved the AM a little bit earlier. The AM kind of did this kind of activity. I tuned the script, but it was much more optimization in that regard. And then once with the blue moon, the courage, I would almost call it, to introduce a new idea, but far and few apart. Well,
you don't want to break what's
right. Ripping something out for where people are going through the funnel, it does look like this. I certainly want to squeeze it out a little bit, but it was very kind of dangerous to do that because they are also interconnected, as I'm sure you would agree. It's not like step 2 and step 7. So distinct that I could do things so differently that there's no relationship to what I did in step 2 to what I'm doing in step 7. So I can't just go bananas on a completely new idea on step 7. There's a whole path of build-up to this point in time.
I just wanted to give a quick reminder that our sponsors of this episode today are Vitaly and ChargeBee. Vitaly are giving away a free pair of AirPods to all qualified demos, so if you're in the market for a new CS platform, make sure to visit vitaly.io/churnfm today. You can also grab a copy of the latest State of the Subscription and Revenue Growth Report by visiting chargebee.com/churnfm and let them both know that I sent you. Now back to today's episode.
So you create that journey. So the first thing, obviously, you sort of say is like the volume then is completely different. So when you're dealing with bottoms up, you just have way more leads, way more signups to deal with, versus on the other end, you really need to be a lot more strategic in thinking about what are going to be the moves that are going to move the needle and less room to experiment and make.
Yeah, and it's almost a double whammy here, which is that in a bottoms up, a lot of what you do is, by the fact that it's high volume, self-serve, meaning that it's implemented as software. As in, it's not a handshake. It is a online funnel for where every action you take, I can implement and analyze. when you do top down, a lot of it is very unstructured. Custom emails, even though they might be scripted, but I certainly want them to kind of fit into the particular scenario, your particular situation, your particular budget, your unique setting, your title, wherever I arrived in the organization. It's very unstructured and many times difficult to implement. So it's not even that it's high volume, low volume. It's high volume, good data, low volume. And even the low volume is poor data or very emotional commentary from the individuals, kind of actors, your SDRs and AEs and CS kind of person, the alpha way. You kind of have to decipher it and apply some sort of value to it. So it makes it not just hard on volume, but even on quality of data.
Yeah. And you said as well, sort of the reason for picking one of the models, whatever. So like going a high touch approach is like one of the cases just being when your product's too complicated to allow somebody to self-serve or to have a product-led approach from that side. What are some of the other reasons you see? And I think like I've also been guilty of this in the past of like choosing a model just because of the skill set that I personally had and didn't feel that I understood. So you alluded to like you need to have the right team for the different types. But what are some of the other reasons and you would choose one over the other?
Surely many reasons. I would pick single player mode as a strong bullet in that list, where if your product does not allow for a single player mode, it becomes much harder, not impossible, but much harder to bottoms up for where any kind of self-serve like thing, you should be able to sign up for Zoom tomorrow and have a single player mode where you're just happy with this particular video conference experience on your own. If you somehow also have to persuade 3 or 4 people to sign up for Trello at the same time, perhaps that's not the best example, but we'll read another one.
Trello you can sort of use.
I think whether,
let's say like a Jira.
Jira, I think, would be a better example of perhaps for it. Sure, you could sign up for Jira yourself and you could have some kind of good stories for yourself, but it doesn't really make much sense. So you should have some single player mode for your product. That's the one part. I think the other strong bullet, if you do have single player mode, is that the onboarding should be very compressed, as in that time to success, or however you want to kind of define that, needs to be very compressed. So many pieces of software will have a long kind of initial touch time period from that to success. It just requires you to do a lot of things. Sometimes it can be days, weeks, months for enterprise software before you start to see some value. If that is very long, self-serve, single-player mode becomes very hard as well. You almost need to have that kind of customer success team in whatever capacity you've designed it to come in and help kind of onboard people. Doesn't mean you can't use technologies, processes, but this becomes very hard. There's also perhaps, not exhausted, but lastly, a price point. So in a bottoms up, and I think we figured this, everybody figured this out, but there's certainly an inflection point for where it should be one of two things. Either a price point so low that you're willing just to take a hit on your personal credit card if there's not a free edition. If people can't take that hit, and or if it goes above, most companies will have anything below a certain kind of price point, you can just write off a sandwich with a customer, X, Y, and Z, and you can't cross into territory where you need to justify a buy. So you probably need to be below that so that, I'm testing out this software. I think we can do our kind of scheduling for our social activity using so-and-so. I pay kind of $20 for it a month. I use the corporate kind of credit card and let you know whether it's a good idea or not. But you need to kind of be below that. If not, now you're into approval territory. And that's really nothing wrong with that. But now you're kind of in a different kind of place where people need to have the skills and tools and arguments to persuade their boss. And that's top-down territory.
Yeah, I think it's Christoph Janzer's got a good post on this. He's like, the 5 ways or whatever it is to build a $100 million company and the different price points being one of those biggest factors of understanding like the different models you can run and the risks. And generally like the very low end or the very high end of the business is then surviving, and the ones that are on that messy middle, which like the four-figure range are the ones that tend to be a lot more difficult to grow and scale because of the challenges
there. Again, at law, side note, we tested every single price point between $2 and $20. We did all sorts of testing above 20 all the way up to 65 at large volume because we could. That kind of very interesting. I'll tell you a few pointers here just for the fun of it. For this particular product, so we did in a prior venture.
What was the product?
We did a scheduling agent. So imagine Calendly, just a different take for the audience who don't know about Excel AI. And the funny thing for this particular product, and it kind of falls into this bucket where you can buy Dropbox, Slack, X.AI, Calendly, and many other things in the kind of $8, $10, $12, $15 kind of territory. We found that any number below five, funny enough, worked against us, as in not better, as in we just allowed ourselves to test, and you would assume, well, it should be better to sell something at four versus eight. It was not. We can talk about why that is. Then every price point from five all the way up to nine, not really any difference. That curve very quickly kind of flattens out, and you might as well sell it at nine. Again, the other one was 14, but the curve was not super, there's enough kind of step in that curve, not very dramatic. You can probably dial it up, and we did for a different edition with a few extra features all the way up to 14. Now, that kind of 19 to 20, that was dramatic. When you go from 19 to 20, I'm not saying you're halving your conversion, but for us, it almost did. $1. And again, you just enter a new territory. What was funny, though, there was almost no difference between 21 all the way up to 39. So didn't matter. 21, 27, 35, 39, all the same price. In this particular segment, in this particular moment in time. So we actually ran with a $39 price point for the longest period of time. Now, then we did further testing all the way up. Of course, there was a very big step once we entered 40. But all the way between 40 and 64 was pretty much the same. Once you entered that kind of 65 upwards, you were entering the kind of Salesforce type contract. It's probably $100 as per seat. And people just got a different taste of what you were selling. It was very interesting. Like tens of thousands of people that we tested on this. We ended up on 8, 12, and 15 in the end, a short of 15.
Super interesting. And like having the luxury and the amount of users to be able to experiment with that. And it sounds like the 20 mark, the 40 mark, and then again, somewhere the 60 mark, like the 20s. Sort of what's tipped the scales and conversion rates and changes. But then again, like raising the prices significantly, like a 35 versus a 14 is, you can get away with half the conversion rate. It's just all about, I think the other side and the concern would be like the viral factor and then how that impacts growth in the long term.
But that's also, so often, which is true, general retention is obviously a closely related cousins, sometimes the exact same thing. Just a different sign in front of the number that you are presenting. What was interesting, though, again, in this particular segment, but it's true for many products for where you have potentials for dramatic negative outcomes. Let me paint a very kind of dramatic negative outcome for a product. Say you have a self-driving car and you hit a pedestrian. That's not a software glitch. That's just a very dramatic negative outcome that is very difficult to survive from, no pun intended. Now, in our universe, things were very Boolean. Again, when we did bottoms up at X.AI, there's no meeting almost set. There's no version of, I almost turned up for this meeting today with you, Andrew. Either here or I'm not. So even though on all these price points, we could test conversion rates, you then make the assumption, I make no changes on the remainder of my kind of ecosystem. They should stay intact. Obviously not. So that means that your willingness to forgive a meeting not set is just not as high at a higher price point. So while I might do all my calculations, excel myself to the kind of nth degree to confirm 19, even though a convert list is a much better deal, you know, sum total for us on conversion, what happens to all those meetings? And like any piece of software, there'll be a glitch. What does that cost me on the other end if the willingness to give is at a different scale? Now it's not immediately kind of visible to us that, hey, with this price, I'm not just optimizing my conversion. I'm changing, you know, another set of emotions down the line, which are not as visible. And that was kind of very interesting. That's actually, now I'm going to go all geek on you here.
It's like the willingness to forgive. Like you have the willingness to pay, but then you also have like the willingness to forgive on the other end.
Churn happens because of many things. It's rarely, on low price points, it sometimes ends up being a single moment in time, even though it really isn't. It's often the accumulation of disappointment over time. But at a low price point, there could be something for where this I just dislike so much that I'll do an immediate churn. But if you really loved it, you could probably survive that. Yeah. Microsoft did, and people could look this up or I could share the papers, this research some years back, which was interesting for what we did in particular, which is that whole willingness to forgive is very different between machine agents and human agents. Meaning that if you screw something up and didn't turn up for this meeting today, Andrew, I could probably assemble some set of emotions where I would forgive you. Like life happens and your two lines of excuse seems plausible. So I'll turn up next week again. Now, if a machine agent did the exact same mistake, exact same set of excuses, you should have the same ability and willingness to forgive. That's just not the case. So we had this kind of burden of having to not do as good as humans, but do better than humans. And when we did a mistake, not have that ability to be forgiven. That was just very hard for me to kind of swallow in that particular environment where we deal with the machine agents.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting. And sort of seeing how the price point also impacts that level of forgiveness as well. It's like, and it's not immediately visible. So you don't really understand that. And you see that in the long tail over time. And I think it goes as well to sort of this idea in terms of like churn and retention is really an exchange of the value on both ends. And it depends like what you're paying. So if you're extracting value and you're paying a large amount, but you're getting a large amount of value out of it, you're happy. Like, and you can put together like a 4x4 matrix, depending on thing, you can see where churn risk is. But one thing you don't really factor in is as the price increases, so does that willingness to forgive on the mistakes that are made as well. And you expect a much higher service and you expect different expectations come with price.
And this is what, and I'm just stating the obvious now, some people might not fully appreciate, which is that when you sell top down, which is again, very different to this particular setting, you can put a lot of empathy points in the bank by doing awesome customer support. Comes in many forms. Could be all the way from your account manager to your customer success team to level 1, 2, 3 kind of support people to your documentation and support articles and so on and so forth. But that whole experience is just the easiest way to put some money in the bank so that when something happens that you didn't plan for, you can withdraw from that. That account will go to zero. But you could actually put a lot of money in the bank on that. And I'm just always baffled as a customer myself, as an enterprise customer myself, where I'm paying for some piece of software in the tens of thousands of dollars, if not in the six figures, why would you not? I think I'm not talking about costly affairs. I think, sure, Amazon, it's all good and nice. You buy me a box out at the US Open and I love you for it for a little while. But really, what I love, it's the 10-minute response time on that email to that account manager on some issue we have on some EC2 instance. Like that, I remember. That, I tell my friends. That, the team will think twice about when Google calls and say, hey, perhaps we should talk about shifting to a different cloud. Like, you know what? Those are things that I remember, and they're not cheap, but they're not the most costly thing you can invest in. I'm just, again, baffled. So I've always tried to kind of overinvest. And again, the whole thing comes back to my new venture. I'm all about making support better. Super nice, but I'm trying to make better screenshots. Like the slice I'm working on is just so thin, but it's just one parameter out of many, many dozens of parameters in doing better support.
Yeah, Very interesting. And you're going bottoms up or top down with Launch Brightly?
I am initially going top down, but I'm building it so that I at least can allow myself to run a few tests on whether there is a bottoms up opportunity here. So one thing which we didn't talk about is either the virality or the network effects that might come attached to your particular product. So we had at H.AI both. So we had very strong virality, which is that for every time you used our product, you invited a set of guests, meaning those guests got exposed to our product. And that meant by far the vast majority of new signups to our product was guests in prior meetings of existing customers. So if we could just keep those customers, see them do more meetings, they will invite more guests who would then ultimately enter the funnel at the top. And that whole flywheel worked very well. We also had some network effects. The whole idea of your product being better than more people using it, for where we increased the likelihood of you meeting another customer. So we could do this kind of scheduling in the barter, no negotiation needed. We could do an internal negotiation. I say, hey, Andrew, let's set up 20 minutes on Zoom last week of December with Laney being optional. As I click send, it's just scheduled. So we had both. At Launch Brightly, I think we might be able to engineer some virality. Very similar to, say, I can pick something from my prior universe, say Calendly. You can sign up for a free account. That free account will have a little bit of a, hey, powered by Calendly kind of dash in the upper right-hand corner. That's the exchange. Seems fair. So I'm generating product features that ends up in help articles. So you have software product, you have 200 support articles, you probably have 500 kind of images in those articles. Who creates those images? Some support individual, perhaps a technical writer. They do it manually. I can do that automatically. But I could probably give you the tool for free if I can insert a little watermark. Hey, it just needs to be a watermark, which is timid enough where you can use it, but okay enough where some people will notice. And then I have this kind of reality. So there's certainly the possible designs where we could do a bottoms up. I haven't tested it yet. We are starting top down, speaking to people in pain, selling kind of real contracts on 12 or 24 months, like very, very standard, and testing that kind of sales funnel. But I do have fantasies of running
it. You saw it at X.AI and you want it back.
Yeah.
Very nice. I feel like we could continue talking forever on these topics, and I really enjoyed this conversation, but I see we're running up on time. I have a question for you. What's one thing that you know today about churn and retention that you wish you knew when you got started with your career?
Oh, that's a good question. Perhaps, you know, it's one of those questions where I'll hang up here and I'll think of something better, almost kind of call you back and say, hey, I have a better response to this. But I do think the one on churn would be that there's two types of data that you should spend probably an equal amount of time on. There's the data-centric, where quantitative data, which you extract from however you implement it, your environment, which you should look at, try to understand your churn environment. Doesn't matter what tooling you use, but you do that in aggregate. And you'll be able to find all sorts of little pockets where the data will tell you something which is very hard to find otherwise. But if you only do that, it feels like, which I only did, I'm a computer scientist, I've only did for my first kind of few ventures. The whole thing was very kind of quantitative. And you were missing perhaps one part of the picture. If you're not willing, able, and eager to just go read some of those kind of support tickets or some of those kind of churn reasons and try to figure out what is it that the customer is trying to tell me, it's very, very kind of qualitative. And you can't necessarily use it as an argument, but you might be able to read enough messages, super kind of unstructured, to get a real feel for why is it that we're losing 8% over whatever kind of time period? For where the data will surely kind of give you opportunities to kind of churn things, but kind of getting that feel, I don't think I did that enough myself. I didn't read enough. I didn't sit as in, I do this all the time. Like every week, I'll do tickets. I think anybody who doesn't run an organization where you don't do tickets yourself, you're blind to some degree. So that I personally didn't do enough. So I'm not saying anything new here. I'm just kind of banging the drum off, please do both. Because I certainly didn't do that.
Do both. Yeah, at Hotjar, we used to talk about the what and the why. So bringing them both together. And the data, you see what's happening, and we're speaking to customers, you understand why.
Yeah.
It's super important. Well, Dennis, it's been an absolute pleasure talking today about the different approaches to building a business from bottoms up and then top down. Getting to hear a little bit about why you would choose one over the other and some of the key fundamental differences and the challenges that come with them. Is there any final thoughts you want to leave the listeners with today before we wrap up? Everything we've discussed will be in the show notes for them so they can pick up on that. But do you have anything else to share with us today?
Two notes. One, if you have no tooling, little insight, 10 weeks out of college, and the whole thing is kind of overwhelming, just love your customers. As in, just really love them. As in, care for them. You'll stumble around, you'll make some mistakes, but they can feel if you actually care for them. And that care is very hard to fake. As in, most enterprise companies don't fucking care about their customers. They're just numbers in a spreadsheet. But you, your new venture, if you really care, that is being felt. So you can forget about, you know, this episode and 40 other episodes. Just mature the fact that you actually do care. That will take you very far, in my opinion. That's the one part. The other part, I am still an entrepreneur. You should go check out notfriendly.com because, well, I'm 7 months into it. I have no money, no prospects, little hope. And you can have a look at it. That'll be wonderful. So there you have it.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, so definitely, as you mentioned, it'll be in the show notes. So you can check that out later as well. And it is launchbrightly.com. So you can check that out there. But Dennis, thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting today and wish you best of luck now going forward.
Cheers. Thanks much.
Cheers.
And that's a wrap for the show today with me, Andrew Michael. I really hope you enjoyed it and you're able to pull out something valuable for your business. To keep up to date with churn.fm and be notified about new episodes, blog posts, and more, subscribe to our mailing list by visiting churn.fm. Also, don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you have any feedback, good or bad, I would love to hear from you, and you can provide your blunt, direct feedback by sending it to andrew@churn.fm. Lastly, but most importantly, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review, as it really helps get the word out and grow the community. Thanks again for listening. See you again next week.
And with that, I just want to say a big thanks again to Vitaly and ChargeBee for sponsoring this episode. If you do decide to check them out at vitaly.io/churnfm and chargebee.com/churnfm, please make sure to let them know I sent you, because tracking podcast advertising is traditionally very difficult, and I want to make sure we deliver value to them both so that we can retain them as our sponsors. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again next week.